Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Even attachment style exists on a spectrum.
Yeah.
I love that you're sitting in front of us. Aww. I know that we didn't ask you and we're not paying you per hour to talk to us, but you are sitting next to two lesbians. And I'm sure
Surprise.
What?
Yeah, we have
sex. This is Raven Simone, by the way.
Wait, what?
This is Miranda Pyramid Mayday. But
full government name for you there, Doc.
I'm writing it in my notes as we speak.
Please do. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Tea Time with Raven and Miranda.
I'm Raven.
Today, this is Raven, in case anyone was wondering. Yeah, this is Raven. Simone.
Yeah. Did you know that?
You didn't know?
No. Holy shit.
Check out cup. She was on that show. It's called The View.
You were on The View. Good for you.
Thank you.
Today on the podcast is actually a first because we've never had a doctor.
Yes,
we've never had an amazing mind in the doctors of world's fields. But today we do.
We do.
We have Dr. Scott Lyons joining us. Hello.
Hello. If it helps, I was a drag queen first.
Were you really?
It does help, actually.
Oh yeah, okay. So it softens the blow.
Yes.
From that sort of, I get
we
it.
We have a you drag queen turned doctor, Dr. Scott Lyons.
They say the best life to have is one that has multiple careers, and boy, have you had it.
I have had a lot. It's part of my, I'm like Madonna, but I like a little bit more of a more extreme reinvention tour.
I love that for you.
Yeah.
Love that for you.
We
you
all
too?
Love reinvention.
Reinvention tours?
I've done the same thing for about 40 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
What would you do? Just kidding.
same thing over and over again.
I've reinvented myself multiple times. Yes.
What's the new reinvention?
Sorry, podcaster, host.
Yeah.
But I feel like one has to reinvent themselves or should reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
And that's part of living and growing and self-discovery.
It's how you stay zesty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we all want to stay zesty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start there, babes.
Let's start
with the first career.
Okay.
Well, first, I do want to just say, though, that you are a holistic psychologist today. That's why we call you Dr. Scott Lyons. Yeah. And we'll go deeper into it after you tell us about your drag queen career.
That wasn't even my first career. I know. I was a dancer.
Okay.
And it was in the arts. It was directing operas. And I had to pay for grad school.
Because people do go see operas.
I've heard they do.
And ballets?
And ballets.
Well, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
If you've never been to Europe, I mean, it's very cheap and accessible there. It's just not as accessible in the United States.
At all.
Yeah. I mean, we both lived in New York.
We know it.
It was expensive. Yeah.
So did your leg come up here?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I was in a show. Do you remember Symphony Space? It was on the Upper West Side.
Oh, my God.
Back in the day.
Okay.
It was a big theater, and I was warming up, and I was stretching and doing my thing, and I did a Batma, which is kick up front, and I kicked myself straight in the forehead and knocked myself out before a show, and I feel proud of it still.
You should. Yeah. That is a great extension.
Thank you. Thank
great
you.
Extension. That is.
And strength.
What's your Batmas like?
Strong.
Strong.
I got a lot of thigh, so the ankle doesn't come all the way to the head. You know what I mean? It's stopped by the titty and the thigh.
You know, there's still time. Reinvention.
There you
Thank
go.
Thank you so much for believing in me.
And flexibility.
And flexibility.
You can work on that.
Yeah.
What was your drag name? Well, you hit yourself in the head, then you decided to become a drag queen.
No, it was around the same time.
Okay.
Because I had to pay for grad school, and I didn't know how else to pay for it, so I started doing, performance art, drag, stuff. It was a crazy time.
Instead of getting on a pole.
I don't think they wanted me there.
She got on stage.
I had great legs. And that was
still
like,
do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You know what? Thank you. I'm going to soak that in.
Yes,
you should.
Please do.
Yeah. Sit with that.
I will. Probably for the rest of the podcast.
As you should.
You know, I had this weird thing where I was growing up in the scene with a lot of famous drag queens now. And they all had names like you wouldn't know their personal name, you only know their drag name. And I was like, well, what if this ends up being my career?
Mm.
And what if I get a little famous? And I was like, I don't want to change my name again. So I just kept it Miss Scott Lyons.
Oh, I love that for you. That's actually good. a great drag name.
Lyons, yeah. Miss Scott Lyons.
Yeah, I was terrible at makeup, but I could kick my forehead and knock myself out.
And now you like really blacked out?
Yeah. Just for a second.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's called commitment.
It's called commitment. And then I had to do a really wild burlesque show after that.
Oh my gosh. Wow. The life of a dancer.
The life of a dancer drag queen.
So then what happened after Drag and Dance?
You know, I just got to a point where I remember sitting backstage at Symphony Space by where we used to
live.
In
Chelsea.
Yeah, in Chelsea.
I don't remember that.
Oh, well, maybe someone didn't take you.
That was didn't take me
purely
Symphony
a
space?
Hit on me. Yeah. And I'll accept that. Because I did it.
She had reinvented herself as girlfriend at that time. As wife, you would have taken me.
This is getting... This heated. Is getting heated.
You're going to therapize us.
I love the drama.
The heated rivalry is happening right now.
You love the drama. We're going to talk about the drama.
We're going to talk about the drama. Yeah, so...
Symphony Space.
Symphony Space. I remember I was sitting backstage and I had started doing a lot more meditation and started getting more like centered in myself and connected and aware. And I was listening to all my fellow artists and they were just talking about all the things they did wrong on stage. Mm. It wasn't one moment, and they were egging each other on, and they weren't even listening to each other. Mm-hmm. It was just like, well, I did miss this turn, and then I forgot to eat and fainted, and then, you know, whatever.
Just trauma on just trauma on trauma. Trauma. Sounds right to me.
You remember the show?
Oh, I remember that shit. Mm-hmm.
And I just remember going, no, this is not what my life is going to be like. And I was like, what is that? And then as, you know, I started investigating, what is that that people are focusing on the negative and that, like, it's, like, celebratory in a way.
And they label it self-deprecating.
Yes.
Or they label it, well, I can see the truth in myself. It's like,
No.
Well, yeah. You guys, I do that.
Thank you for your honesty.
No, seriously, I do that a lot.
Actually, real honest.
The self-deprecation, that to me, though...
Yeah.
And I'll be super interested to hear your perspective on it. If I say it first, you can't say it about me, and therefore I'm owning the hurt. Okay. I think it's different in a way than maybe what you were describing amongst the artists just kind of like shitting on themselves. But if I see that I messed up or if I hear myself say something that didn't come out the right way, if I'm able to say it first, then... I don't get hurt by another person. / if I see things in myself that I don't like physically in my appearance, the way that my brain has been kind of wired, I imagine everyone else is seeing them. So therefore I want to tell you I see it. So you don't have to think it, because then I feel some awkwardness. So I'm like, listen, I know I have this pimple here. I know that like I'm not wearing makeup. Like that's where my head wants to go.
Yeah.
Like I know that I haven't like gone to my electrolysis appointment, blah, blah, blah.
No one's looking that close at your chin.
I know, but I look very, but I'm so hyper detailed. And
did you see her chin?
No.
It's beautiful, ain't it? Nobody's going to
show me your chin.
No.
Look, and then she covers
show
it with
me
hair.
Your chin.
I'm not showing anyone my chin. But that's why I do that.
Yeah.
That's why I do that. And I feel like...
Would you say it's a shield?
Yeah. I
or
think
a guard?
That, totally. I think it's... Yes, it's a way of protecting myself.
Yeah. Do you know... You know, what's so interesting is most negative self-talk, it, like, arrived before the age of 11. Right.
Yes.
So at the age of 11, we go from a very egocentric perspective of like, my parents are getting divorced, it's because of me, to starting to be able to then see more of the world and go, actually, they got divorced because they were funky. But until that age, we start making sense of the world through our own causation of it, no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those negative self-talk, and if you were a child actor, I don't know if you were.
I don't think I was. I think I was entirely different. Because honestly, I didn't have that.
You didn't have that?
I didn't have the world is seen through me and everything is about me, because I was taught at a very young age that I am not the center of the universe.
Who taught you that?
I'm writing a book.
I can't wait to read it.
It's my parents taught me that. I'm not the center of the universe, and somebody else in my family was.
In a negative way or?
In a narcissistic way.
Mm.
Yeah. So at a very young age, I knew that there was something going on. At a very young age, I knew that if I saw something, that's probably not right. Like all the things. So I've heard so many people say that, and I'm like, wow, I wonder what that feels like.
Yeah.
She must have had a time just because developmentally, well, unless you're saying your developmental, which I guess in a way you are, was so supercharged, but correct me if I'm wrong. I remember hearing that basically just in terms of like milestones, right? Mm-hmm. Like a baby is born and then by 3 months you hit this milestone, 6 months here, a year here. There are milestones developmentally in terms of what you're understanding or processing where it's like up until 3 years old, you really only have the capacity to see the world in the way that you just described. Maybe an 11-year-old would... You know,
I was on TV by the age of three. Mine was different.
Yeah.
That's a different world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also like you're seeing yourself through a lens and a screen, I imagine.
I'm
projecting. I have no idea what you're saying.
Let me say it. I'll say it as concise as I can. Reason why I don't think that I totally understand the aspect of looking and seeing the world through my eyes is at three, I was on a show that created scenarios that I had to act in, mm-hmm. even though they were not exactly how I would react in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to live outside of myself in order to do that.
Yeah.
So therefore, when I go home, I'm wondering.
Oh, that's layered.
It's.
Oh,
I'm writing a book.
You're just writing a book.
But I want to go. I want to go back to the doctor.
Where did the? I want to know where you discovered that this was your path. And that you were going to now reinvent yourself into?
So I was already a therapist in my early 20s, but I went back to the arts. And by the time I was in my mid, late 20s, I was working on a huge show with one of the biggest bands in the world. I cannot believe I got the job. They, joke's on them. And, and it was so awful. It was, I just remember being like, I don't like my life. Like, I'm not happy. I was really broke trying to make art in New York City, my own stuff. And I had so much fun and to a point, and then trying to pay the bills was almost impossible.
Yeah.
As nice as my legs were as a drag queen.
Don't pay the bills, boo.
But, you know, I got to this point where I was in a rehearsal. They threw me under the bus. They were screaming at me. And I just was like, no. Yeah. And I got up and walked out. Unheard of for that size.
People usually just take it.
I mean, this is one of the biggest rock bands in the
world.
But
what I'm loving right now that I'm hearing from you is that there are these really definitive moments in your life where you're like, no.
No.
And that is really difficult for a lot of people to do.
Yeah.
That, to me, shows that you have a bigger purpose. You had a bigger purpose. You actually listened to it. You listened to your body. Mm. And I feel like that's a little bit of the basis of your work, listening to your body and understanding that when your body says no, you have to listen.
Yeah.
Is that where that comes from or am I projecting?
Let's just project all day. I'm having a good time.
Isn't that all we do?
No, you're such a good listener and reflector. You both are.
Thank you.
I'm here for it.
We're here for you.
Such a sexy quality, I will say. I mean, I'm not asking you out on a date.
But if you were,
how would you do
it? Dearest friends.
Oh, yes.
Would you like to go on
yes, please.
And then it would sound like that for the rest of the
date. Croissants and coffee immediately.
Delicious.
Like how you filled in with croissants and coffee.
That's exactly. What I heard. That's
no, I think I've asked
only a few people out in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
You're not the asker?
No, not necessarily, but I get really awkward.
Make them come to you.
Yeah.
Teach
period.
Me. Teach
Maybe
me.
Come to you.
Teach
awkward
me.
Moments build character, though.
They really
Oh, yeah?
Do.
Can you I have so much character.
Me too. Can you explain what holistic psychology is versus just psychology?
So the traditional, and when I say traditional, I mean in the last 40, 50 years, because, let's see, I did the math wrong, but 75 years.
Okay.
Math was not my strength.
Yeah, we're artists.
And psychology has typically been of... You have some type of disease or illness. Something is wrong with you.
Yeah.
And
diagnosis.
It's like we're going to diagnose it.
Yeah.
And we're going to follow a very strict treatment plan that has nothing to do with the person you are.
Period.
Or what's been going on in your life and or what resources work for you or what particular practices work for you. And holistic psychologist is about like, okay, there are so many approaches we can take to what's here. And what if what's here, regardless of what it is, right? Like severe depression, right? What if that has something to do with inflammation?
Smart.
What if that has to do with the way you survived when you were three and you had to perform for other people in order to be loved?
Mm-hmm. I feel heard. Continue.
Oh my God. That's my love language, is you feeling heard.
I feel heard.
You know? And so a holistic psychologist really sits back and meets the person who's here in front of them, as opposed to seeing them as a disease, seeing them as an issue. They are not the issue. Yeah. Their survival responses are not working for them in a way that is optimal.
They haven't upgraded them.
They haven't upgraded them. Set.
My question to you, it feels...
We're playing footsie on
it. Yeah, we are. We're already on our
I'm not jealous, you guys. I'm not jealous. It feels the holistic psychologist that, and I don't know if you created it, but I'll give it to you. It does feel catered to the genre of art. It feels catered to that human being, which everyone can be, but the human being that understands the different layers of self.
Yeah.
And how important it is to just not push, you know, somebody aside just because they don't fit. One of my favorite memes is, you know, you see a professor at a desk, there's a huge tree and then a lineup of a horse, a elephant, a fish, a monkey, and a snail. And he's like, whoever can get to the top fastest wins. And it's like, that's not how we should be looking at our life. And the fact that you are diving into this world to help people with a not one size fits all canister is absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We aren't one size fits all. It's I think it's counterproductive. It's also dangerous to act as though people are one size fits all. Oh, you have this diagnosis because you have a few criteria.
Yeah.
The bullshit.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that this is what you need in order to heal.
Mm-hmm. That's
fair. I feel like it can be, well, when I think about it, it becomes so overwhelming to my brain because I think about doctors and I think about the number of people we have in the world, and there are systems and those checklists kind of put in place to try and keep organization because we don't have enough time and resource. And I feel like that's part of the problem is not everyone, not every doctor is able to sit with somebody for the amount of time that it would take to understand all of their nuances, all of the things that have happened in the past, which is why in a therapeutic relationship, it's ongoing. Yeah. But I even think about in a medical sense, doctors are coming in and out. They're like, okay, this, here's that, try it. They're practicing medicine.
And those doctors barely even get to understand nutrition, we heard.
Exactly.
Nope. Maybe one class in med school.
Right? Which is all so convoluted and twisty, but it makes so much sense when you understand why people are as stuck as they are in so many ways.
Or you give apple juice after a surgery.
Yes, exactly. Or you're giving, you know, Coke to chemo patients as they're sitting there and sugar.
Diet, baby, it's Diet Coke.
Oh, I got excited.
Oh, he was like, wait, I'm ready for
Wait, what?
Diet Coke.
You know Diet Coke. I mean. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You're drinking like
I
Coke and
that.
Sprite during your chemo, and it's like cancer is going to feed off of the sugar. It's just, it's all kind of backwards. But I do understand how there's only so much time allotted to any certain person in a day. Some of it comes to, you know, pushing it back on the individual, where it's like you have to go find your resources and learn yourself. And it's just a lot. I think getting our brains right and our bodies right takes a lot of work, which is also wild because it's, should just be like the primal thing to be comfortable and know how to be in your body, and we've lost it in so many ways.
Yeah. I wish it was. I mean, the problem with accessibility is that it then becomes simplified. Mm-hmm. So we see on social media like a lot of coaches and therapists, which I have no issue with any degrees or training or anything like that. I think anyone who's good at what they do is qualified.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, like, there's so much shit people make up.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing to make it up if you're researching it. It's another thing to make it up because it grabs attention, and that can cause harm. There's a lot of like diagnoses that I see online, and I'm like, what? I don't think that's real. Like, it's not real. I'm like, it's, you might be reflecting a certain pattern that someone has, which is beautiful, but there's no, like, to make up a condition and a reason for it is just.
Could you be more specific?
Narcissism. Like,
oh, you don't think it's real?
No, no, no. It's not that I don't think it's real. I think that we, most of us exist on a line, so to speak, of having narcissistic traits. Like, depends on the wound you have and at what age you had it.
That's fair.
So it's a spectrum?
It's a spectrum. Yeah.
Because there's a difference between being a narcissist and having narcissistic personality disorder.
Or narcissistic traits. Like, or I have narcissistic traits. You have narcissistic traits.
Anyone in Hollywood has narcissistic traits.
No, I'm sure I do.
Yeah, we all do. We all get like, you know, someone's telling us, hey, you really hurt my feelings. And we go, well, you hurt my feelings. That's a narcissistic trait.
Yeah.
It's a inability to be with yourself and someone else in discomfort. right? And so it becomes really complicated when everyone's a narcissist or everyone has BPD or whatever's hot this month.
Yeah.
Or everyone has this insecure, avoidant attachment style. Even attachment style exists on a spectrum.
Yeah.
I love that you're sitting in front of us. Aww. I know that we didn't ask you and we're not paying you per hour to talk to us, but you are sitting next to two lesbians. And I'm sure
Surprise.
What?
Yeah, we have
and this is Raven Simone, by the way.
Wait, what?
This is Miranda Pyramid Mayday. But we...
Full government name for you there, Doc.
I'm writing it in my notes as we speak.
Please do. Thank you. But we are the generation that have experienced the life without the internet.
Oh, yeah.
And quick diagnoses.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are the generation that also gets a lot of our information from TikTok and our diagnoses. And one of the things that I know lesbians do a lot, we like to self-diagnose each other and have multiple conversations day in and day out. It's a stereotype
like
of lesbians.
Like WebMD.
Yeah, we're like natural WebMDs.
You love to process. Oh. It's making me wet, by the way.
You're welcome.
Thank
you. Here's a napkin. But let's talk about the thing that you just brought up, which was the anxious and the avoidant.
Yeah. The attachment styles?
Technically, I'm the avoidant and she's the anxious.
No.
Oh my God, can you believe it? So, what shouldn't we
That was not a formal diagnosis, my smirk, by the way. I just want to be very clear.
I was like,
did
you already know that?
Yes.
Really? How did you know?
Just the way you interact.
That's fair.
Our tells.
But watching the way you interact is more important than than a diagnosis. Like, if I just go, okay, you have avoidant. Okay, well, I know, like, first of all, it's not in the DSM, so there is no actual diagnosis of that. Sorry, folks, unless it is so extreme, and so few of the population actually have that. But a lot of us are on this way of, you know, needing to close up a little bit more or extending out past our own boundary because we feel like we aren't being met.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just becomes, like, if we look at it more energetically, you asked me how I knew. Like, there's a way that I experience you reaching a little bit closer, right? Or no, closer, where you feel really solid in your place. And I don't feel that extension past your, what we call a boundary or kinesphere.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, is that a diagnosis? No. Is that a pattern? Yes. Let's look at patterns and get to know the human with this particular style and orientation towards survival than simply going, well, this is what you do and this is what you did.
Yeah. I think to your point, just about the quick culture that we live in now of just, you know, TikTok, oh, I have this, I have that. When you really start to understand that people are layered and people do have patterns and people are all responding to certain forms of trauma and certain genetic makeups, then you go, well, you can see yourself in everything in some way. Like, we all would go, oh, you know what? Sometimes I do kind of like totally disassociate and I'm
dissociate.
Sometimes I totally
say it the same way.
It's dissociate.
I know. I know.
Dissociate.
Are you from the Midwest too?
No, I'm from LA.
Oh.
I just thought it was disassociate.
It's not, but I love to say it that way as too.
And how do you?
I don't even, my English didn't make any sense. I love to say it that way too.
Dissociate?
Dissociate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's dissociate, baby.
Okay.
So, you're always better with us at words.
Yeah.
Since I was three.
your therapist
I
taught
lost
you
a
had,
shoe.
Your therapist taught you how to say that just like
yeah,
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, because she said, if you're going to have it, you better say it right. I'm like, you're right.
There you go.
I love my therapist. Right.
My point is just we all probably could pull from things and pull from true diagnoses and go, oh, this is me. And therefore, people just think that is them, but it's not.
Mm-mm. One of the hardest things to give up in healing is the identity you formed around the trauma.
I was going to ask you that. Do you feel like we're doing that because it feels better to have a diagnosis than it just feels just be willy-nilly?
It's a container. It gives us our like inner chaos and experiences something to be held in and helps us organize it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we focus on anything, it becomes a habit. That's what a habit is. It's a repeated behavior and focal point. And so what becomes really challenging is like it's hard to give up It's like I'm a victim, or I have avoidance, or I'm narcissistic. It's hard to give up, even after we've healed a lot of the original wounds.
It feels like we always need an identity instead of just being a human. And that goes back to the thing that we were talking about 2 seconds ago, that it's like you go to school, you have to learn your math, your English, and this, but they don't teach you the fact that you do have an aura, the fact that, you know, what things that your body's actually doing in order to regulate itself. You know, there was a moment even in my therapy, I started rocking and I'm like, oh my gosh. She's like, calm down. Why are you tripping? Because I started tripping because of all the people that I saw
rock.
And I'm like, oh no, do I have this now? And she's like, what is wrong with you? I'm like,
it's self-soothing. Just self-soothing. You're being one of those humans.
And that's what I think we need to normalize.
We need to normalize complexity of being human.
Do you guys know your tapes, if you will? Do you know the things that you...
Do you believe in the tape?
Well, no, let me finish my explanation.
Like BDSM tape? What are you talking about?
Yes!
I do! Wait, what are we talking about?
I'm talking about the tape in your head. So you were saying...
Oh, the belief system.
The belief system. So the things you tell yourself...
He needs to be our doctor all day. He went right to BDSM.
I'm here for it.
The things that we tell ourselves over and over that become our patterns, that become then our belief systems, that then become the things we're addicted to, that are then harder to let go of. Do you know yours?
That's also our tape on the count of three.
Period. Mine is too long.
Well, I do know mine.
Okay, what's yours?
Mine is that I will never be good enough or amount to the things that I dream of amounting to.
That's painful.
I say that out loud, and then I think about what would happen if it shifted, if that shifted away.
Who
would I be without it?
Yeah.
That boss-ass bitch.
But then I'm like, okay, I want to be that, but how do I get there? But I can't let the tape fully go for some reason. It's so tricky and twisty, and it's not from lack of...
This is my wife's favorite conversation.
It's not from lack of wanting to, because I've really been working so hard. It's just, I don't know the way.
Being aware of something and wanting something to change does not create change.
Right.
And that is a painful reality that are like, I'm aware of my patterns, therefore I can do whatever the fuck I want. I don't know where that accent came from, but I'm here for
it. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Keep it
Midwest
up.
All day.
Oh God, you know, I don't know where that pattern came from, but I just am going to, you know, stuck on it like a little
came from Minnesota. Of a cow.
Thank you, Bobby. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, oh, Bobby.
Yeah, it's more here.
Oh, yeah, I mean, they are... You know, if you think about those inner scripts, those inner tapes, those belief systems, we hear that more than anything else in the world. Because whether we're aware of it or not, those scripts are playing out. They act as a filter for how we perceive the world and how that we believe the world perceives us. And so to be able to start to get distance from that is so important. And there are a lot of really beautiful techniques like EMDR or...
I love EMDR.
Polyvagal theory, like in action, or what else is good? Like, there's a lot of great somatic trauma approaches that help you get underneath the sort of loudness of the tape and get into the wound and get into the ways that we have constructed and held the fragments of ourself together, which is what we call the protectors or those, you know, the ways in which we've tried to survive, and they can become our strengths and they can become our weaknesses.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. And I've done a lot of work. I've been in a lot of therapy in my life, and I feel like I used to say this. I used to say my awareness, because I'm very self-aware and I will call myself out until I'm blue in the face, but my self-awareness has no impact on the experience. That, you know, it's not helping me produce change or release things. And I really feel like the work that I have left is on a somatic level. Yeah. It's really about, like, bypassing the brain almost and getting into the subconscious and the body.
You got to move faster than you can think. Yeah. You got to process it. You
know? Exactly. Exactly.
Scott, I want to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about you.
I thought we were.
No, we're talking about your work.
I'm really good at avoiding that, but let's do it.
Oh, are you an avoidant?
Trust me too.
You feel
that's just a, he's a little bit
like
of everything.
I feel like no one can hold my experiences in my life, so I hold other people's.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Watch this.
I got okay.
Where'd you grow up?
We about to hold you.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up between Minnesota and the Bay Area. Okay. So not in between, like a state in between.
Yeah,
but
I was like, what is that?
Yeah, I don't know the geography.
Kansas?
I don't know.
Yeah. You jumped homes.
I jumped homes.
You were jumping homes?
We lived, I was born in Minnesota. We moved to California. The economy crashed. We ran for our lives.
Yeah.
And back to Minnesota. And then I lived in New York by you.
Yes.
For almost 20 years.
Mm. When you credit the household you lived in, sorry, let me read this correctly, that you grew up in such an unstable household and credits this to leading to his own addictions to drama.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the household you lived in. When did you have awareness that something was wrong in your home?
Well, I mean, in my house, the police were called a lot.
Oh, that's when you knew. Got it. Easy.
Easy. And, like, we had social workers and people say, like, you know, there was a way that I learned to excuse my parents' drug addictions and behaviors towards me and the severity of the abuse. And I was just like, well, that's maybe what love looks like because I'm a bad boy. Mm. And like, I am not good at learning. I don't learn my lesson fast enough and blah, 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 you know? And I remember hearing from like social workers of like, this isn't normal. And I remember going, yes, it is.
It's normal for
you. Because it was normal for me.
Did you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a great sister.
Older or younger?
Older.
Oh, years. How was she towards you during that moment?
She was always the mother I never had. Mm. And so I have so many, you know, I'm a traumatologist. Like, I study the science of trauma. And what's interesting is, there's a thing called the ACE score, which I'm sure you maybe have heard of. It's kind of the evaluation for how many early traumas you had and how many challenges.
ACE score, but there's a chart that I did, I think, that has those questions on it. It's called the mode something. Okay, cool.
Yeah, there's so many evaluations. Okay. And I remember as an adult taking the ACE test and going, I won the highest ACE test. Like, I am in the, you know, the very top level, and going, but that doesn't make any sense. Like, I work with people who have ACE scores like this, and they're in jails and they're in hospital systems. I mean, I've gone into both of these to help support these individuals. And
what do you think it is? Was it that voice that told you no those other times?
I think it was the no. I think that I still felt like there was love in my family. It was just so, it was a roller coaster. One moment they were doing something really terrible, and the next moment they made me give them a hug, which we're hugging now. and that level of pattern stayed with me. I mean, I dated so many addicts and people who would beat the shit out of me as partners and then totally blank out and be like, I don't know what you're talking about. You made that up. And it took me a long time to go, oh my God, I overcoupled love and abuse so that because it was always a roller coaster, I expected it. In my mind, I was like, oh, this is the roller coaster of love. Yeah. This is what it's supposed to be like. Yeah. Exactly.
It's the work that needs to be done in a relationship.
Yeah. And the hardest fucking thing is, and what got me into the work that I do, is you can't give it up because it is the most familiar thing you know. And that starts to be the stability in your life in ungodly chaos.
And then do you find that in understanding that that is the most familiar thing you know, that the healthier thing feels so foreign and so uncomfortable, so you can't tolerate it and you push that away.
Yeah.
When you were growing up and you were in all of this chaos, what did you do to self-soothe? Where did you find your outlet?
The arts. I mean, when you ask, I had
creativity.
If I didn't have that, I don't know what I would have done. My parents they didn't know what to do with me. And so thankfully they put me in everything. I was in ballet and I could kick my forehead.
You can say it. You were a ballerina.
I was a ballerina. I was in dance. I was in theater. I would sing. I was in youth politics and, you know, policy reform as a kid, as a young adult. And like, these were all these containers to put this energy that was chaotic into a vehicle that felt better towards the world. And I think I could only hold on to that for so long. And then it became apparent I was destroying myself.
Was there anything within your sexuality that was a part of that too?
You mean as a straight man? No, I'm just kidding. I just wanted to fuck with you.
Look at her, I was going to fuck with you. But I'm like, so as a straight man.
Hilarious. She was right there.
Oh, we got this improv. yeah, as a straight man. No. Wait, I don't even know what that's like. I had this beautiful experience with my people in my life. They are also, you know, Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score. Mm-hmm. And they were staying at my house last week. And it was such a sweet moment. We were teaching together. And he leans over to me and he was like, I'm really proud of you. Aww. And I was just, I felt like this wall where I was like, huh? Like, what's next? Like, if I let my guard down, I'm not going to be protected. And I softened a bit because he stayed with me during that. And I said, is this what it's like to have parents? And it was an honest question. It wasn't like a theoretical question. I was like, wait, is this actually what it's like? I don't know that experience. And so part of the healing process is to fill in the gaps of experiences we never had, in addition to healing the sort of fragmentation and the wounding that also occurred.
One of my favorite sentences that I'm being sarcastic about you not only learn how to be by being, but you also learn by not.
Yeah.
And I remember saying back to someone, yeah, but if I always learn how not to be, how do I learn how to be? You know what I mean?
Like, I do.
It's a great way to cover up the BS that happens. Well, at least you learn how not to be.
Yeah.
Like, but then I'm just stuck because I don't know where to move.
What? Yeah.
You know? And that's kind of sounds like what you were
saying. That moment, though, I just want to go back to that moment for a second, because what you had, that, in my opinion, is healing.
Yeah.
And I often say this to Raven. I think one of the most amazing gifts we can offer another person, and we often see this happen in relationships, is having a person who is secure enough in themselves to stay stable, to let their partner work through whatever they have to work through. And I think it's such a gift, because most people don't have the patience or the ability to stay. And I feel like the people also doing the work a lot of the time don't understand how to differentiate between, this is my trauma and my shit and I can't let it be taken out on my partner, but they're gonna let me go on my journey, respecting that boundary.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I think that's so beautiful and so generous that he stayed by you to let you go through, to feel your guard. And obviously you were aware enough to feel it, play into it, decide how you wanted to proceed. Yeah. But I wish that we offered more of that to each other on an overall, because I think that it would help humanity, because peeling back our own layers is so complicated, and no one wants to feel unsafe or vulnerable or exposed. But when we get the chance to go to those places, that's where you start to heal.
Yeah.
And become better. And I've had glimpses of that in our relationship, where that tape for me is much, it's changed a lot over my life. It's not as loud as it was by any means, but having moments.
Because I didn't like that tape. I'm gonna stop you. I don't like it. I told her a long time ago.
I don't like your tape either. We're not gonna like each other's tapes. They're, you know.
Yeah, you don't like, but go ahead.
I'm just saying, like, no one is gonna like the thing.
No, but I don't like your tape to the point because it is
so untrue.
It's so untrue. Yeah. Like, you've seen my tape is No One Listens to Me, right?
Yeah.
That shit happens. Listen, you've witnessed it in business meetings.
You've seen mine, though, too, baby.
No, I've never seen you ugly. I've never seen you worthless.
Okay.
And I've never seen you say any. I've never seen those things come to light.
This is the really interesting thing. Just because you can see her in the light doesn't mean she can receive it.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
You know,
right.
And that's the complicated piece of it. Yeah. Because if you were to let go of the scripts there, it would also mean letting go of the tension patterns and the breathing patterns all of these other things that have worked around this sense of safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so safety of letting go and being with a partner and being vulnerable isn't actually safe for a lot of us. We have to build the tolerance and the capacity to do that.
Oh, this is like my brain is on fire, because it's so real. And people, I'm sorry, I know, I hear you.
Go ahead.
But it's so real, and it's so much of the work that I've been doing in terms of the body. And I listen to somatic practitioners, and it's literally learning how to breathe differently. It's literally tongue posture.
Yeah.
It's all of these things that people would poo-poo or stick their nose up at, but it's so
fucking real.
He jumped into that topic, so I just want you to explain somatic body work so that people who don't understand, because it's not new, but it is new.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not new. It's actually before, you know, 75 years ago with Freud and all that, there were actual therapists that focused on the body.
Beautiful. Mm.
And then there was kind of a recurrence of the movement in the 60s, 70s. It got a little messy with, you know, drugs and other things, which we can talk about psychedelics. But and then got conservative again. And then in the last 7-8 years, once the Body Keeps the Score came out, along with a lot of other practitioners, it was a game changer.
Yeah.
You know, like I used to teach somatics 20-some years ago, and people were like, the fuck?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I teach somatics. And they're like, they want to tell me what it is, which I think is just so cute. I was like, tell me.
No, I want you to tell us.
Okay, I will tell you. So soma means body.
Okay.
And somatics means the living body. And what that means is about 97% of what's happening in your body right now is underneath your awareness level. But 100% of what's happening in your body is dictating your perception, your choices, your behavior, the way you feel right now, the what you're taking in and not taking in. All of that is underneath this level of awareness. And so somatics is not only increasing the level of awareness to be more, you know, the ways in which you push your tongue up when you're feeling stressed, or the way I grip in my throat or my chest when I'm trying to be nice. You know, we all have these body-based patterns because especially when it's early developmental trauma. So before, two, three, we don't have two things. We don't have a lot of language. Right. And we certainly don't have explicit memory. So autobiographical memory, which means like where you remember you went to the store and then you got this and you got that. That doesn't start till really, really after three. You can have bits of it. So the majority, especially of our early developmental trauma, is held in the body. It's held in the posture. It's held in the breath. It's held in what we take in terms of sensations and what we don't take in terms of sensations. The way we interpret in the insula or other parts of our brain that sensation and make meaning of it, which isn't actually, you know, real to what's happening in this moment. So
an insula is by the, is that by the medulla oblongata?
It's in there.
Okay.
It's all up in there.
Just so that y'all know where it is.
Yeah. Good job. So you guys know. Raven it's may over not there. Know, but so you know.
Sorry, yeah. Keep going.
No, I try not to say brain words, because it's also one of the things we've done in the last 15, 20 years as fMRIs came out is we started like just trying to put everything in the brain. And it's not.
But it's in the stomach.
It's in the stomach. Well,
The
second brain, yeah. And we do, like in the brain, we do interpret the sensations that come from the body and make meaning of it. So if every sensation, like I do this sound where I'm tapping the teacup, and part of you goes, that's scary. It doesn't make sense because there's nothing outwardly scary about it per se, but you know, trauma is not about making sense. Drama is not about making sense. It's about making sensation and interpreting it and having a disproportionate response to it.
Yeah. And I feel like from things that I've explored, and tell me if you believe this too, I feel like some of the transference of trauma, pain, discomfort can actually come even when you're in a belly.
Oh, yeah.
So it's so twisty because I feel like there are some nervous systems that are set up for a harder experience from the get-go. And it has to do with what your mother was experiencing in her life and what her mother was experiencing.
Was it an onslaught of cortisol constantly?
Yep.
Did she have any like significant diseases, anything like that?
Yeah.
Like famine, we've seen, has radically altered the sort of baseline sense of safety in the children who came after, the generation that came after a famine.
I am curious to know, you mentioned stress.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on stress? How are you?
Love it.
Yeah?
No, I fucking love it.
Tell me.
Well,
why?
Can I get on my high horse?
Please.
Thank you. Okay. Stress is one of the most overgeneralized medical phenomenon we have. Absolutely. And it is so wrong. And this is what, and like, you know, I teach a lot of this and write about it because it's so important to know that, like, when, you know that word activation?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, I'm activated. I'm like, that means you're alive. If you weren't getting activated, it means then you are in a chronic freeze position, which you are not any healthier. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I say healthier, it's a form of preservation, survival, but like, so we tend to put extra meaning on stress language. Stress is bad. It's a big bad boogie monster in the closet that's going to kill you. It's not. Mm. Here's the thing that stress does. So stress in and of itself is our biological process of adaptation.
Yes,
it is how we are flexible human beings. And if you are not flexible, then that is when disease starts to form.
Can I pause you?
Yeah, please. Yep.
If you're not flexible, you get eaten.
It's true.
Period. That's it's why true. We have stress, so that we know, and all of our adrenaline comes into our body so we can run away.
Yeah.
But continue. And
but
then
people do get stuck in that in over. It. Yeah.
Well, they because they no longer get eaten by nothing.
They get right. stuck in the inability to finish the sort of cycle, the
oh,
loop.
Wow.
So the first, there's, I'm going to break it down on a really easy level.
He's off his high horse on the shoulder horse now.
I'm on the showroom horse.
Okay.
So the, it's easier to point to the whiteboard on it.
yes, put it up.
Oh, I thought that was you for good.
It is.
It is you.
Yeah.
I don't remember your hair that long.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like it. But I like this too.
Do you remember my hair that red?
I don't remember your hair that red.
Or my face that long.
No, but oh, I do girl. Remember that lipstick, and I loved it.
Thank you.
This is called an ADHD tangent.
Period.
No, just kidding.
We were all diagnosed on TikTok.
I had AUHDH. There's not AUHD.
Yeah.
I used to tell people that I had celiacs and ADHD before it was cool.
Aww.
Yeah, there. Me too.
There. There.
No, again, it's an important container to help us organize a lot of our experiences, yeah. which are hard to organize.
Okay, so stress.
Stress. Thank you. So the first thing that happens in a stress response is what's called activation. Mm-hmm. It means that there's a whole release of nervous system responses, hormones, what are called glucocorticoids, stress hormones specifically, that flood into our system. Mm-hmm. And we want to say hell yeah to that, right? We need that. Do either of you like to get up in the morning and eat breakfast?
I do.
You do? Thank cortisol for that. That's, I mean, we have these cycles of stress response
yeah.
that are essential for our survival.
Yeah.
The second stage is what's called mobilization. So all that energy is freed up and goes into our body to respond. The misinterpretation is we go, it's about fight or flight. It's not. It's about any response that helps us be adaptive.
Okay.
Any response. A ball's coming at you, you catch it. You duck. You hit it with your chest. I don't know what you do.
Yeah.
And all of those are mobilizations.
That's right? Like you see a car coming at you, you move out of the way.
Exactly.
Again, to like continue putting these yeah. into kind of simpler
yeah.
terms.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
But it doesn't have to be extreme. It can be like, I'm having a conversation. I need to be more attentive and full of energy to respond and adapt to the situational need. At work, that's a stress response.
Yeah.
It's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
The third stage is called deactivation is the third stage.
Okay.
And deactivation just means that our blood flow returns back to our limbs and our guts. We're more in a place of emotionally digesting things of what just happened. We're more reflective because we can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important time period. And then the final stage of the stress response cycle is to recuperate. So mm-hmm. we literally recuperate all this mitochondria and we build up the energy reserve so we can keep doing this all over again and be adaptive.
Okay.
And the interruption to those cycles, like when we tell kids, oh, you have a little impulse, stay in your seat, right? All of these ways we subdue and suppress
yeah.
people's impulses of adaptability
yeah.
are teaching them that their responses, their mobilizations are wrong or bad or going to harm people. Sometimes they do, but it's a very rare thing.
But also this is the thing again, if we were taught
yeah.
how to work with our natural impulses,
yeah.
then they probably would probably be so much better in our human bodies because
yeah.
all of that is part of being human. It's primal,
yeah.
like we see animals do,
yeah.
and what we can even observe in watching an animal that lives in the wild or an animal in captivity, yeah. they've adapted.
Yep.
We are essentially animals in captivity.
Yeah.
We are constantly having to subdue or work around our natural ways of being, which then create consequence, which then create depression, anxiety, mood imbalances, all of these things. And then we're being traumatized and inundated at the same time. 100%. It's just a rigmarole.
So, for example, let's say we're throwing a ball back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I scream at you because of how you're throwing it, or you threw it last time in the street. And you go to throw it and you freeze up, right? You brace up. You don't complete the action. Where does that go?
That goes into my belly.
It goes into your belly.
And then I go eat a sandwich. And then the feeling
trying to get it out. Because there's a serotonin, a change, yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, we all have our different strategies of navigating it, but it can't exit. That energy reserve stays in our body, and the locking, the bracing, also stays because it's just a preparatory energy. And that creates inflammation.
Yeah.
And one of the root causes of autoimmune disorders is chronic inflammation and depression. That's
all disease, basically.
Yeah. We know that, like, people who take GLP-1s have a higher success rate with depression than if they take an SSRI.
Can I explain to you right now that's crazy. Is real?
Yeah.
It's real. That GLP-1 is not just for weight loss, mm-hmm. you guys. There's something magical about that little fucking thing. And I was watching,
low dose.
High or low?
No, I just mean, like, for inflammation, it's a low dose.
Oh, yeah. I'm on a high dose and I'm thriving.
Do you love it?
Let me tell you,
I'm so jealous.
She's so mad.
I want to be on it so badly because Raven, number one, said, sorry, I just took that from
she's,
you.
She loves you.
But no. But when Raven told me that she didn't have food noise, and I said to you the other day in the kitchen, you're like, it'd be a waste of money. And I was like, you are crazy because if I didn't have food noise, food noise has defined my life. Mm. And my eating disorder has basically been something that I've had to battle every day of my life since I think, in my memory, about 7 and a half.
Yeah.
And if that were gone, I don't even know. I've found ways to manage myself and whatever, like most of us do. But that would be incredible to me. And then, yes, you said you are so calm and that your nervous system is so settled and you don't feel nervousness. And I think Raven has given me her nerves because she was performing on stage and I was dripping in sweat for her, which has never happened to me before.
That's called stress contagion. There's actual research on that. But we can get into that
later. But she wasn't stressed. I was only stressed.
You have different baselines. Yeah. She's been a performer her whole life. Well, minus not the first 2 years.
I was pretty dormant from day zero to day 16 months.
Lazy.
I was so boring.
Lazy.
So lazy. I was disappointed in you.
Bag of bones.
Get my life together.
Get it together.
16 months sucked.
But it's true. You have a different baseline. And this is the really, again, why we have to look at holistic levels is like my baseline, what I can tolerate. Like, I can sit through people telling me the most horrific war stories, the most horrific traumas, and I go, okay.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it doesn't.
You're not
shocked. No. And I've always had a high
capacity. But if you see a puppy, you're crying.
I wish. No, or not. And sometimes that's the sad part, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. For in this example, and maybe I wasn't clear enough or whatnot, but Raven was cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
She was the only one going on stage. I wasn't going on stage, but I'm I was sitting in the audience, like having a full panic attack. Mm-hmm. Maybe doesn't have anything to do with that situation. Maybe my hormones, I was just having, it just happened to be when it happened.
Yeah.
But you're saying that there could have been some kind of transference?
Can I make huge leaps on behalf of both
make
of you?
All
yeah,
the leaps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Raven is better at suppressing her physiological responses than you are.
100%.
And so.
Preach, Doc.
Yeah.
It's like, so what you might have been, like if we did a spit test, we could have measured both of your cortisol levels at that point. It's not my favorite way to measure cortisol, but that's neither here nor there. But we might have seen that you had the same level of cortisol. But what Raven's cap is might be different than yours. So your tolerance or capacity level for a certain amount of influx of that activation might be shorter or smaller
100%.
Than Raven's. And so what we deem as calm can sometimes be subdued or suppressed or repressed, or sometimes it's a greater window of capacity.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense. And that is
and
totally
any
factual.
Other time you guys want to be read, just let me know.
Honey, we love being read for the gods.
Keep it up. Read me all the way.
Read me.
Yes, please.
I have a big stress response when my phone rings. When I get a text message from my mother, my heart starts racing, my armpits sweat, and the world is about to end. She calls me and she just needs to make sure I'm okay. And I'm like, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong.
Well, you spend a lot of time appeasing her. You want to throw the mic again?
I'll do it.
I was going to sound like on the actual podcast.
Oh, it's going to be
like
so good.
Like a mic drop.
Just a mic drop.
How can one try and distinguish between something that is actually urgent?
Yes.
Or, and something that your brain has made you think is urgent? I feel like that's the same.
Such a good, because anxiety loves to use urgency as its like main weapon, right?
Yeah.
It's like everything is now, 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 and we live in an urgent urgency culture that's telling us that if we don't text them back now, or if we don't share that post now, like something's going to happen to our preservation. We'll be forgotten, for example.
Yeah, please, right? Somebody forget me. Jesus.
You're unforgettable.
People, lose my number. God damn it. Sorry. I know you gotta, you know, I'm not your client right now. But just, right now. But just to listen to advice, every time that phone rings, I feel like it's urgent.
Yeah.
What are the small steps that one can take to
like
calm that down?
Like somatic practices. Yep.
So one of the things is to turn your attention to something else.
Food.
I'm open.
Okay,
like,
no.
Here's
okay,
the thing,
not
I'm not gonna diss any of your choices.
Right.
Because I'm better than that. And no, I'm just, adding a level of shame is not going to help anything here, right?
It is, yeah.
Like, there was enough of that shit.
Yes, there was.
And so I go, okay, so you're going to turn your attention to food, but I want you to take the time to taste your food. Mm-hmm. I want you to slow down or speed up towards something else. Because what happens in trauma, you know, early attachment trauma, adult trauma, it's all the same in this regard, is that it robs us of the choice of where our attention is.
Ooh, yeah. Say that one more time.
Trauma robs us of where our attention is and how much attention something gets. And then you take it a little step further and it's like, then we also have no choice about how we utilize our energy resources, our attention, and our biological resources to adapt.
And then our adrenals are just fucked.
And then our adrenals are fucked. Yep. Or we overreact when a phone call comes
and
in.
And then your hormones are a mess. And
yeah.
La, la, la.
And it's hard because it's like, if I were to say to most people, you're overreacting, and don't say that because it's fucking
triggering.
Rude. But it's also, it's true. They are overexpending their energy resources, their attentional resources, and their biological resources to something that isn't proportionate, and they're not responding in a way that's proportionate to the needs of that given moment. That's the definition of trauma.
And trauma's taught.
Oh, that is so
That's
real.
So good. Trauma's taught, because that last sentence you said, I was taught to respond that way by the way my parents responded to situations and by the way their parents made them respond to situations.
Yeah.
So it's taught, it's learned.
Yeah.
It's this, I think that's called generational trauma.
You know, the biggest one, and you'll totally agree with this.
Yeah, trauma.
So my mom, and hi mom, I love you.
We love you, Mr. Teresa.
I know you watch the podcast. She said something to me the other day and she's like, you're just airing everything about me on the podcast. And I was like, yeah, you're welcome.
She texted me.
You're welcome. Yeah. In your last session with her. But my mom.
She's not a patient. I actually have to legally say that.
Yeah, she's not.
She is
and
not.
We're not as patient either. Yeah,
no one is patient.
No one's my patient.
My mom was an actress.
Oh.
And she was very emotional, and there was a lot of drama in the house.
Yeah.
Highs and lows.
Yeah.
And one thing that I learned was that, and it came to mind with our dogs, because
tell the story.
I don't know which story I'm telling or what you're thinking of, but what I'm going to say is what I'm about to say.
Oh.
There is this heavy dramatization and play out around, or dramatic event around the dogs.
Yeah.
Whether it's because one got out, and then the screaming, the terror that like would fill my body. I mean, like trembling as a little girl because the dog got into the front yard, because she was so terrified, just jacked me up. And Raven has seen that, where with our dog, you know, the fear that I had have learned, the trauma response in my body around the idea of a dog getting out or not being trained appropriately was so overwhelming. And the thing is so often in my childhood, there were situations that would occur, like the hysteria around a backpack being left at the door. Mm. In my mind, I was like, but you could just tell me to move it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, why are we screaming at each other over this thing? Why are there tears? It didn't make sense.
Why are we putting a birthday candle out with a fire hose?
Exactly. Yeah. And for me, I've had to now see in my adult life where I will sometimes have these extremely strong reactions mm-hmm. and responses to things. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, wait, that I didn't need to go through that at all. And I'm the one who suffers the most. I mean, like, people have to receive me and they'll be like, wow, Miranda, you're absolutely insane. But I'm the one who actually ends up suffering much more because then I hate myself for behaving that way. I don't know why I did. Then I'm also dealing with the physical drain of it all. And I feel like it's all just so there's no real question here. It's just it's so fascinating to me to understand human beings and why we do the things we do. And we all do it.
We're so fucking complex. That's the thing, like...
And then also so simplistic.
Yeah. And so, yeah. We are basic bees and and just, you know, simplistic and very complex.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever met somebody that you feel like has really just, like, done it? You're like, you are so evolved in your...
And don't you dare say
in your experience. He wouldn't dare. In having this conversation, I'm like, all of us have so much trauma. Yep. There's just, have you met a person where you're kind of in awe of them because you're like, wow, you've really done the thing.
Yeah.
Figured it out.
I think some people, like there's a lot of opportunities to not be in the trauma. Like, I'm not as fucked up as I should be. And I really should be. You know, like when I see like some of the severe addicts mm-hmm. I worked with, I'm like, that should have been me for all intents and purposes. And so you have to go back and it's important to go, okay, well, what else was there besides the trauma? And that's really hard to pay attention to because our attention is pulled towards the things that harmed us most. And it's like, I had this great teacher in eighth grade. She believed in me more than anyone else in my life. I had a surrogate mom who like, was always saying, you're going to be an amazing artist. You know, there's these people in my life. And even like the moments that were safe enough for me to take in my parents, they were nice and they were encouraging. And that makes a significant difference. How much of the resources you have. It includes financial resources, which is fucked. It includes social resources, relational resources. All of these things will affect the outcome.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're doing. I mean, with being the creator of the Embody Lab, you are teaching in over 20 countries the somatic stress relief, a holistic process of restoring biological resilience. You've taken your experience and have created something for others mm-hmm. to find relief, the good stress, the positive.
Yeah.
And if you look, you will find it.
Yeah.
You just have to look. You've also, I just want to touch on the book that you wrote called Addicted to Drama, Healing Dependency on Crisis and Chaos in Your Life and Others. I think for those who don't think that you have a problem, cool. Look at your life and everyone can improve some way.
How can someone tell if they're a drama addict, according to you?
Well, I think what happens... how often you get bored, how often you get anxious. And I think, and that's not an addiction to drama, but oftentimes when things start to settle or calm down, what happens when you take a bath? Does your mind start to go a million miles an hour? What is preventing you from being here in yourself? Mm. And then we have all of these, why an addiction to drama was so hard to write is because we have all of these tactics that are almost invisible to stir up that level of activation, that stress response, and then maybe have an explosion, which is not the accurate way to mobilize or move it through. Mm-hmm. And part of the hardest thing, and it's like, I still have this every once in a while, is like, you know, I was on a plane last night and I thought the seat was broken and I could feel myself getting ready to write an email to customer service. And then I realized the seat was fine and I was kind of sad. And I was like, that is such my old pattern. That I don't get some vehicle to have this big explosion, to feel something, to feel alive. And I mean, I've gotten to a point where in my life where I was like, I just laugh at it. And I'm like, ugh, oh, you.
Oh, you.
Still working your shit through. But it doesn't escalate. And it wouldn't have escalated in the way that it did when I was, you know, in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And just like, and it was also, our relationships are a good indicator. Mm. Right? My relationships are always a roller coaster. Mm. Always a severe roller coaster. And I found people who weren't a roller coaster boring. You know? And that was really good information.
That is really good information. And I find that people who often are in that roller coaster, that is a play out of a wound or some trauma. And I have friends, I'm often the person that my friends will call when they're having relationship issues. But so much of the time I will say, like, I have a specific friend who's like, oh, he's just so boring and he's this and that. I'm like,
oh my God, that girl loves
boring. I'm like, what he is steady and he's calm.
Yeah, you do.
She's not your patient.
No, she's not my patient.
Just what he is steady and calm and grounded, and he's a safe space for you. And because you're not getting to play out your pattern, it feels unattractive.
But she don't listen. Sorry, I don't have any patience for her. She don't listen. And she's never, you could give this book to her all day. She's going to be like, well, it's not audio. Here's the audio. Well, I'm busy. Okay, well, you're busy. Well, go sit down. I've cut so many people out of my life that don't want to listen.
Boundaries.
It's really ridiculous. But I listened to you today. And I want to say, do you have any openings?
No.
No? I think you should find an opening.
Well, I have an opening. I have an opening.
We can hang out.
Let's hang out!
Let's just hang out.
You guys, dear little biscuits out there, we're not going into the teapot today because this conversation was just too full and delicious on its own, because it was. But you know what we will do?
What?
We'll toast.
We'll toast. What are we toasting to?
I'm going
to
tell you in 2 seconds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Today on the podcast, we are toasting to the Scream Club.
What up, Scream Club?
It all started in Chicago when a couple, Mandy Hernandez and Elena Sobolevada, had a tough week. Manny, a coach and breathwork expert, suggested they let out their feelings. The pair headed to Lake Michigan, where they screamed into the abyss. Then people around them began to join in. Now they host a weekly meetup where people are invited to write down what's bothering them on biodegradable paper, drop it in the water, and scream to their heart's content. Scream Club is now a movement, with several U.S. cities starting their own chapters.
Amazing. Is the ink also biodegradable?
Period. No sea turtles.
You know, I tried to do that.
Scream?
I've tried to scream. You've talked about it with me. I can't do it.
Have you done a rage room?
Yes.
You guys want to go?
Yes.
Like right now?
Let's go right now. Let's do this shit.
Let's start right here, right now, with these teacups.
I want to thank Miss Lyons for coming on.
Me too. Miss Scott Lyons.
You are.
You and your legs and those arms out. Come on, girl. You got it.
You better work. No, honestly, you're doing some amazing work out there. And I think that, especially with the generation that's pushing mental health and to understand it, it's so important for every culture.
Yeah.
Because we also know there's blockages within cultural parameters.
Yeah.
But somatic release and somatic work is colorblind and age blind.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you for standing on your high horse, teaching us and giving us some good tools, whether it's your book, your online platform,
your social media,
and just you being you and authentic is amazing. So thank you.
If anyone listening today really resonated or feels like some of what we talked about they are dealing with in their life, what would you say is their first step into more self-discovery or...
I mean,
TikTok.
Well, what I will say is there's so many free tools out there now, and I'm so happy about that. You know, feel free to, we have a lot of free stuff on the Embody Lab. We have like summits and stuff like that, which are all tools. Mm-hmm. And don't do it alone.
Mm.
Do it in community. We heal in community.
Yeah.
And that is how it has been for so many years, until in the last 75, where we just locked people in a room with a therapist and said, heal.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Love that.
So good.
Well, thank you, everybody, for watching Tea Time with me and Miranda, Raven and Miranda.
That's me.
You guys do work on yourself. You know, that's such an interesting statement. It's like, oh, you got to do the work. The work means listening to yourself and what your body is saying and then healing it from that space. Yeah. We love you guys. Put whatever you want to put in the comments. We'll read them if they're nice. If they're not,
we'll delete and block you. Dr. Scott Lyons, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I hope you don't delete and block me.
She's not wrong.
You're nice. You can stay.
See you next week.